Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Edward Hirsch. Edward Hirsch teaches poetry at the University of Houston. Yes?
Yes.
And he is the author of How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, published by Harkett Brace. This is a very special book because, to my mind, what it does, I mean, no one is going to believe me, and so I have to begin with a complete disclaimer. I'm talking seriously. These are the poems that you should read if you want to fall in love with poetry, because they're astonishing, because they're weird, because they do things that other things don't do, because they have odd moments that you can't predict, that everything they told you about poetry that you didn't believe turns out to be true of these poems. They change your life. They alter your perceptions. They do remarkable things. I have a great deal of distrust, you know, of people who want to make me fall in love with anything. But insofar as anything can be predicted, you are very likely to fall in love with these poems, and thereby perhaps by poetry. But these poems are so good that I'm terrified that after reading this book you won't find enough of the right ones to continue. So there's actually a reading list in the back that will keep you going. Now, I wanted to begin by asking you how you came to want to write a book that would teach people how to fall in love with poetry.
Well, thank you for the wonderful opening statement. First of all, let me say I began with poems I loved rather than beginning with ideas. And it seemed to me every book I'd read about poetry was really a book that was started with certain ideas about poetry. It didn't start with the poems themselves. And I really wanted to start with poems that had often affected me really deeply for ways that I didn't quite understand. And I wanted to try and tease it out. Well, in the last few years, I'd found that many people were interested in poetry, a kind of hunger for poetry, but people had been taught it so badly that they didn't know how to go about it, and that I just had encountered through my work at Double Take magazine in particular, but just at poetry readings and in trips around universities and various places in the country, a group of interests of I would call readers of goodwill who were interested in poetry but really felt that there was something they were deeply missing in it. Somehow it was going past them. And I decided as a kind of service that I would speak out of my passion about these poems, both to poets and to uninitiated readers.
Well, it's also that this book is definitely a book that comes after the big parade of modernism. Once upon a time, there would be a book like this full of poems that you would open up, species of the modern poem, and the one guarantee is that you would not understand a single one of them, that not one of them could be read on your own. One of the pleasures of this book is that when Edward Hirsch is talking about these poems one by one, he's invoking not an experience you didn't have and trying to explain to you what you should have known and should have felt. These readings are almost hand-in-hand readings of what you probably did feel and did see. They are a guided tour to your own emotions, which is a really pleasurable thing.
Well, thank you so much for saying so, Michael. It's really the case that I believe that we effectively experience the poems. I just try and point out how they're actually working on you. Mm-hmm. So you can look a little more carefully and a little more attentively at actually what's happening. But when I read a poem at 8 years old and it totally blew me away, I think I was responding appropriately to what the poem was doing. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have a language to try and help articulate how I could reproduce the experience again and the ways in which I could see how the poem was actually doing it to me.
Well, one of the poems in this book, in fact, one of the very first poems in the book, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry by my guest Edward Hirsch, is a poem that ignited me. Now, I have to tell you that, and I've said it many times on the show, poetry didn't start to work for me until I got to college. And I thought that people who told me that they liked it were kidding, you know, that it was like something like opera, that maybe when I had a beard I would understand.
If you were like a lot of Americans, it was taught to us so medicinally.
Uh-huh. Well, it was also that I never understood why we'd be sitting for an entire hour looking at eight lines. And, you know, it was so protracted and so slow. And my feeling now, of course, is if it doesn't get you right away. Keats, whose poem we're going to be talking about first, said about poetry writing that if it doesn't come as leaves to the tree, it had better not come at all. And in a certain sense, if the poem doesn't just almost blank you out,
that's
obliterate
right.
you, you're not going to love a poem until you have that experience. But these poems are more likely to do that to you than some of those, you know, tough chestnuts that they give you.
Well, we were taught that poetry had to be difficult and that all the meaning of a poem resided in the paradoxes and ironies. And I just don't believe that. I began with, you know, when I was in my 20s, I began to find poems in translation. And then I began to find the romantic poems that had been kept away from me that were not all about irony, that were often really avid and passionate and literally tried to come off the page and grab you. And those poems I responded to emotionally first. And I thought, what would happen if you try to write about about poetry beginning with the emotional domain of that and then follow it from there?
Well, I'm going to start by being sort of a show-off, because the poem we're going to talk about is the first poem I ever learned by heart, so I'm going to say it without looking at the page.
Thrilling.
And Edward Hirsch can guarantee that I'm not opening a book. This was the last poem that Keats was known to have written. It's considered to be a fragment. It was found in the margins of a play, a poetic play. He was writing a comedy called Camp and Bells. And we've come to call it This Living Hand. This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights that thou wouldst wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again and thou be conscience calmed. See? Here it is. I hold it towards you.
Chilling.
Yeah, I think that one of the scariest poems in the language.
It's chilling.
Let's start. Tell me about
beautifully,
it.
Beautifully recited. For one, you and I both took it to be a poem unto itself, and it just leaps out. But Keats scholars haven't dealt with it very much because they don't know what to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wrote it in the margin of this comical poem, and they were probably the last serious lines of Keats that Keats ever wrote. I think they stand brilliantly as a freestanding lyrical fragment or a poem unto themselves. The lines are just so haunted. The thing that's so distressing about them is that you can't console yourself when you read this that Keats wanted to die. You can't say he was ready, his time had come. He wasn't ready. He desperately wants to come off the page and grip you. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to go. And he doesn't seem to find any consolation in the fact that his living hand, he perceives that his living hand is going to be replaced by lines of poetry. And he doesn't want to be treated as a poem. He doesn't want to be treated as lines on the page. He wants to literally come off the page and grip you.
Well, it's also that, it seems to me, that he wants to hold your hand but knows he's not going to do it until after death.
That's right.
And that experience is going to be so scary that you'd rather die yourself.
To give him... I mean, he actually asks you to sacrifice yourself so that red, you know, so that blood can red life can flow in his veins again.
And this, for some reason, you see, the technology of this poem reminded me, pardon me for the real simplicity of this image, of those very amazing cards that I would sometimes get on my birthday that you would open up. And something would pop up at you, paper
well,
technology.
It's really the case. Well, he wants that hand. When he says, I mean, I find these some of the most haunting lines in poetry I know, where he says, you know, and thou be conscious, calmed, see, here it is, I hold it towards you. I mean, he is trying desperately hard to bring his real hand off the page to touch you, and the trauma is that he doesn't want it to be a metaphor. He wants to touch you literally, but he knows he can't.
Eddie Hirsch has in this book a poem that would not normally be associated with This Living Hand, but it's a poem written literally before a poet's violent death. And in its way, both the imagination of death and the actuality of death cause words to have a lurid, terrifying life. And so I thought we would next read Postcard.
Should I talk about a little or read it first?
Well, just the briefest of explanations of the background.
Just that it's a poem by a Hungarian poet named Miklos Radnati, and he wrote it on a forced march across Hungary. And maybe I'll say more about the circumstances of that after we read the poem. And he wrote four of these poems, and this is the last one, called Postcard. I fell next to him. His body rolled over. It was tight as a string before it snaps. Shot in the back of the head. This is how you'll end. Just lie quietly, I said to myself. Patience flowers into death now. Der Spring knock auf, I heard above me. Dark, filthy blood was drying on my ear. I mean, these seven lines are almost unbearable to read. They're written totally on the edge of the grave. Radnati was arrested let's put it this way. Language was put to a grave test on October 31st, 1944, when Radnati wrote this poem. He was marched westward across Hungary by the Nazis, and near the town of Abda, sometime between November 6th and November 10th, 1944, he was shot along with 21 other prisoners and put into a mass grave. And after, on the plains between Yugoslavia and Hungary. And after his death, his wife had his body exhumed. He was 35 years old. And in his jacket, in his field jacket, they found a small Serbian notebook, and she found these poems. I mean, these poems literally rise up from the grave. And it's a particular kind of consciousness, it seems to me, who can enter art space on the edge of the grave, because this poem is a made thing. It's not a diary entry. Mm-hmm. But to actually make a poem where you know that your own death is facing you in the most literal way any moment seems to me the most extraordinary enterprise. And it's so Orphic that literally it comes up from out of the grave to tell us about what the experience was.
Well, not only that, is it Sylvia Plath who says that the bloodshed is poetry?
Yes.
And there's this moment here where another man has been killed first, and
right.
The poet is sprayed with...
shot in the back of the head. He feels the blood on his own ear.
On his own ear. And we feel it almost in the same way that hand rises up in the Keats poem. This poem spatters us.
It's incredible that you feel the blood. I mean, and you can't say he didn't know he was going to die. He just saw what happened to him. He's trying to calm himself, what's happened to the person next to him. He's trying to calm himself down. And then he hears the German voice say, you know, look at this one still moving. Look at this bud about to break open. And then he feels the dark blood on the ear next to him. You can feel it yourself. It's wonderful to link it to the Keats poem because Keats also tries to come off the page. I'm very touched by the fact that this poem was titled Postcard. I mean, the Keats poem, we attributed the title This Living Hand. Scholars gave it that name. But Radnati titled this poem Postcard. And what's so touching about it to me is a postcard is addressed to someone else. He's not just writing it for himself. He wants someone else to read it. And you might say that a postcard in a way acknowledges its own inadequacy. He knows he can't account fully for the experience. You can't on a postcard. It's just a kind of quick notation of what you're about to read. It's directed to one person, but anyone can read it because it's so open.
I'm speaking to Edward Hirsch about his book of readings called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. Now, here on the one hand, we have a Hungarian poem, and we have an English romantic poem by John Keats. What is the spectrum of poems that you consider in this book?
Well, unlike most books about poetry, which really confine themselves to English poetry or to American poetry or to French verse or whatever, I began with poems that I've loved, sometimes for 25 or 30 years, and I just followed them out from there. And that meant, because like every poet I know, I'd been influenced by poetry and translation, poems in languages I do not read, I decided that I would also read about, I'd also write about those poems. I'm aware that, for example, when you read the Radnati poem, you're not getting the thing he wrote in Hungarian. You're getting a translation, in this case, I think a pretty good one, by Polger, Berg, and Marx. But nonetheless, you're getting a translation or an adaptation. But what I found was that reading Radnati, I'd never heard anything quite like that in English before. And there are things existed in other languages that just didn't exist in English, and I found so much in this poetry. I mean, earlier you brought up the Anglican poetry that we were raised on in a way. And I wasn't accustomed to encountering poems that had this much emotional heat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the poems have, I just started with poems that have a very high effective content that really sort of blow you away by how powerful and passionate and present the poet is in them. So I began with those poems. So, for example, I read a Baudelaire poem, a prose poem called At 1 o'clock in the Morning. T.S. Eliot seems a little less original once you've read Baudelaire, since Baudelaire does most of the work that Eliot does in terms of inventing modernism and modern urban life. I read poems by Federico Garcia Lorca or Cesar Vallejo or Nazım Hikmet, the Turkish poet, as well as some canonical poems such as Elizabeth Bishop's extraordinary Villanelle, One Art, Pablo Neruda's poem, Solo la Muerte, Nothing but Death. I just go through a whole spectrum of poems, some of them modern, some of them ancient, many by Anna Akhmatova, a Russian poet that I love very much.
As a matter of fact, let's go to the first of the Akhmatova poems that you use, because it's been years since I read Akhmatova, and when I came upon it as I was reading your book, which I must say delighted and intrigued me more and more as I became aware that this was not exactly a teaching book. It was a book of shared pleasures. And that instead of being outsmarted at every turn, as I've been by so many literary critics, that emotions that I share with you were ones I luxuriated in with you at the proficiency of the description of not the intellectual experience of the poem, but the emotional experience.
Well, thank you for saying so. I tried to describe the poems always keeping the emotional domain open and recognizing that that's what first attracted us and appealed to us in the poems. My book isn't a textbook. It's not meant to be a textbook. It's really meant to be a guide for readers.
Mm-hmm.
And it really starts at a high emotional pitch, and it tries to stay up there all the time. I mean, I really try to give poetry the wings that I believe it deserves. And Akhmatova is such a histrionic writer, as Whitman and Dickinson are, that she never let me down.
No. When you come to this poem in the book, you just go, oh, if you've never read it before, it's as fresh as, well, read it.
Well, and also it's remarkable because she was a terrifically young woman when she wrote it. As I say in my book, this is the opening soliloquy, the first dramatic speech of her career. I was helpless. My breasts were freezing. I walked one foot on tiptoe. I put my left glove on my right hand, like an idiot. There seemed to be so many steps then, but I knew there were only three. Autumn whispered through the maples, die like me. That sick, truculent liar, fate, has stripped me for the hell of it. I've been flayed like you, I remember answering as I left, and I'll die when you do. This is the song of our last meeting. I looked back at the shape of the dark house. Candles guttered in the bedroom window, indifferent, yellow.
Edward Hirsch reading, what is the title of the Akhmatova?
It's Song of the Last Meeting.
Song of the Last Meeting.
Marina Tsvetaeva responded to two lines in this poem so remarkably that they're a model for me of how to read, and I wonder if I could just read them to you.
Oh, I'd love it if you'd read them.
It's this astonishing image where Akhmatova says, I put my left glove on my right hand. And Tsvetaeva says, when in the first poem of her first book, the young Akhmatova conveys the confusion of love in the lines, I drew my left-hand glove onto my right hand, she conveys at one blow all feminine and all lyric confusion, all the confusion of the empirical, immortalizing with one flourish of the pen that ancient nervous gesture of woman and of poet who at life's great moments forget right and left, not only of glove but of hand and of country of the world, suddenly losing all their certainty. Through a patent and even penetrating precision of detail, something bigger than an emotional state is affirmed and symbolized, a whole structure of the mind. A poet lets go the pen, a woman lets go her lover's hand, and immediately they can't tell the left hand from the right. In brief, from these two lines of Akhmatova's, a broad, abundant flow of associations comes into being, associations which spread like the circles from a flung pebble. The whole woman, the whole poet is in these two lines, the whole Akhmatova, unique, unrepeatable, inimitable. Before Akhmatova, none of us portrayed a gesture like this, and no one did after her. That's reading. That's reading poetry.
Now, I wanted to bring to bear, because I get letters to the show a lot, and I got one once from Alaska. It wasn't cynical. It wasn't contemptuous or ironic. The woman simply said to me, "These poems that I've heard on the show don't sound like the poems that I heard growing up. For one thing, they don't rhyme, and I'm not sure why they don't rhyme." But she went on to ask the more interesting question, in that case, what is a poem?
A lot of the poems I like do rhyme, but, I mean, there's actually no single feature intrinsic to poetry, I believe, that is can be identified absolutely with the medium. The oldest word for poet in Greek means maker. And I suppose the simplest definition of a poem is a made thing. But it's a verbal construct, an event in language. The word poesis means making. And so I suppose making is as close to word for poet as a maker, and the poem is a made thing.
Well, what I found myself telling her, because I tend to answer my mail as much as possible, if it's personal mail, was that if you look at a poem now, the poem will tell you what that poet thinks a poem is.
That's right.
And in fact, you can say what a poem is by describing the thing you're looking at, which is the thing that you do so very well in this book.
Well, thank you. That's exactly the process of this book. I mean, my idea is that poems enact what they're about, and that many great poems teach you how to read them. And not only from that poem can you find out how to read, if by attending closely to the poems I read, you can find out not only how to read this particular poem, but how to read a poet's whole body of work, or a whole genre of poems, or a sequence of poems. So the poem itself, the naked poem, is a kind of naked truth for me, and the poem often teaches you how to respond to it.
Now, in this book, by and large, one doesn't encounter poems that one is not going to understand or at least feel on the first reading. But what do you do when you encounter a poem that you genuinely are mystified by?
Well, initially I try and, I mean, at a certain point you decide whether it has anything in it for you. There are some poems that seem so difficult, you just say, it just doesn't speak to my condition. And it's just not for you. Sometimes you just look back and you just keep looking at the words and seeing what they say. Sometimes it helps to know the situation in which the poem was written. Sometimes it helps to know how the poet is unfolding. Sometimes it helps to read some surrounding poems. You take some genuinely difficult poets, such as the late Wallace Stevens. He's a poet that really has to teach you how to read him, because so much of the poetry is about meditation and meditative process. It's not about trying to figure out what each line is saying. It's about the mind at work. And so you learn to let it flow in a way in your response to it. And, of course, that's very true for a more difficult poet than Stevens, such as John Ashbery, a more elliptical poet. But even so, for example, I think that as I write about epiphanies in my book, How Epiphanies Stop Time, thinking about stopping time through epiphanic moments helped me think about Ashbery as a poet who never wants epiphanies, who keeps postponing epiphanies because he wants to just keep going. Hence a book like Flowchart.
Now, this is always the difficulty, because half the time we say, you're going to understand this book, and then we use the word epiphany.
Right.
But this book has a glossary.
Right.
Tell us about
it. Well, thank you for pointing it out. That because people are traumatized by poetic terms, I decided to write what turned out to be, 120 pages in manuscript, in which I defined every poetic term. But one reason I decided to write a glossary myself is because I looked at a lot of the other glossaries and they seemed completely inadequate to me. Because you could look at a glossary and you could find out what a sonnet was, but you never found out from a glossary why you'd want to read one and what was in the sonnet and how it worked. So I tried to write a glossary. Well, to cheer myself up, I decided that I was putting myself through Bardic College. And that when I graduated from Bardic College, I had to be able to define each of 125 poetic terms. But even more than that, I had to find a splendid example from the history of literature, and then I had to explain why it mattered to the reader, how it worked on behalf of the reader, what was in it for the reader, in a way. Because I think that really a poetic term such as epiphany is just naming an experience. You have the experience. I'm just trying to give you the name for it that helps make it a little more accurate and how to and give you a consciousness for what's actually already happening.
So an epiphany really is when you come to understand something suddenly at the end of an experience.
That's right.
With a kind of awe and recognition.
It's a sudden illumination. It's a Christian term originally. It meant the revelation of Christ to the Magi. But James Joyce secularized the term and used it for Dubliners. But really, what it really means is a spiritual insight or sudden illumination in which something radically, suddenly comes clear to you.
I want to finish this show with Edward Hirsch, the author of How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, which is both a book of readings of poems and of poems themselves. It's both an anthology and a critical book, by asking you to read a small poem by Whitman.
It would be a pleasure to do so. This is a poem of, I would have to call it, spiritual attainment, because he puts books behind him and encounters something deeply spiritual in the universe. It's a conjuration. He conjures up his own soul on our behalf. A clear midnight. This is thy hour, O soul, thy free flight into the wordless, away from books, away from art, the day erased, the lesson done, thee fully forth emerging, silent, gazing, pondering the themes thou lovest best, night, sleep, death, and the stars.
Edward Hirsch reading Whitman. Edward Hirsch is the author of How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. Thank you for joining me today.
What a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Our engineer is J.C. Swadek. Acting associate producer today, Carly Eisman. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thank you for joining me on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.